British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 19. The entrance hall to Arena's block of flats has two broken panes of glass on one side that let a steady breeze of air into the vestibule. There's a sign in Belarusian stuck to the lift doors saying that it's broken. So Gabby climbs up 6 flights of stairs until she finds flat 605. Gabby can hear a door chain being laced into its holder. Then the wood swings open a tiny fraction, and Arena's face appears in the gap, pressed up against the side wall.
Tak,
she says. Gabby talks in Russian.
I know your family from Moscow. They said to look you up.
Who?
Your uncle Artemy,
says Gabby.
I'm Anna.
Comms branch had constructed the life of Anna Volkov yesterday, as a rush job, after Gabby called them. Anna was born in Moscow, and had moved to Berlin when she was 4 years old, as her father is German. Her mother is from Moscow, and her family knew Uncle Artemy, because they lived nearby. Hence him suggesting that Anna calls on his niece in Minsk. Irina looks her up and down, then closes the door, unlaces the chain and pulls the door wide. Gabby goes in and Irina locks the door behind her.
So this is Jacob, she says. Your uncle said he'd grown.
They talk about Jacob and children and families, and Irina makes tea. As the time moves on, Gabby starts to feel she is nearing the edge of outstaying her welcome, so diverts the conversation closer to the real reason she has come here.
Your uncle told me you have a bad relationship with Jacob's father.
For the first time since Gabby arrived, Irina seems uncomfortable.
I have no relationship with him,
she says.
He told me his name, Florin something.
Irina only stares at Gabby.
Your uncle met him recently, apparently.
Gabby continues, even though she can see Irina is becoming increasingly nervous.
Florin's trying to find you. I know. Your uncle told him you live in Minsk now.
Fuck,
says Irina. Then realizes Jacob can hear her. She gets up and goes to her bag for a cigarette. Pulls one out and lights it. Her hands are shaking as she stands near the window and blows the smoke out into the daylight.
He sounds violent, says Gabby. He is. I have a friend who has a place where you could go.
Irina keeps staring at Gabby.
Is this why you came? Your uncle told me to visit you to see if you're okay,
says Gabby.
Look, my friend has a big house in the forest, near Dubno. You'll be safe there. Who are you?
Says Irina.
I told you, I know your uncle. And he said it sounded like the guy was on his way here. He's worried about you. Why are you doing this? Don't you want to keep Jacob safe?
Says Gabby. Irina looks at her son playing with bricks on the wooden floor.
I've got a car,
says Gabby.
You could disappear for a couple of weeks, then come back when it's all blown over.
Irina turns her head and her large Russian eyes look out towards the horizon, her mind considering everything that Gabby has said. Then she turns back to Gabby, nods slowly, and takes a last drag on her cigarette before throwing the butt out of the window and closing the latch.
You go and pack, says Gabby. I'll mind Jacob.
Irina disappears into the bedroom, and half an hour later, the two women carry large travelling bags down the flights of steps to the entrance. A hire car sits at the closest parking space to the main doors. Gabby loads the bags into the boot, and Irina straps Jacob into a back seat. Gabby starts the engine and accelerates out to the main road, then turns left towards the Białowieża forest. A thin man in a light grey suit appears around the door to the interview room. Ella doesn't know him, He holds out his hand and introduces himself as Rodney Pirbright, and tells her he is a lawyer and will be her representative for these police interviews. When she asks him how he knew she'd been arrested, he doesn't answer directly. He does ask her to relate what happened earlier in the day, and Ella talks about the trip to the supermarket, then discovering Stefan's body when she returned home. Rodney is forensic as he explores the details, and explains to her that he needs to know everything, but that is different to what they may decide to tell anyone else. He particularly asked about how she instantly knew Stefan was dead when she first saw him from the doorway of her sitting room. She tells him she doesn't know. She just assumed it. Rodney writes notes on a yellow pad. Why didn't she call the police immediately? They arrived before she could do it. Why didn't she want to let the policeman in? She doesn't know. She was still in shock. Rodney nods and writes that down too. After an hour, an inspector arrives in the interview room and asks Ella to relate the events again. But this time her recollection is shaped by Rodney's advice that he gave her at the end of their discussion, 10 minutes before the inspector arrived. At the end of the discussion, Rodney asks for her immediate release pending their investigations. The inspector tells him that they will be formally arresting Ella, given what she said, and they will be keeping her in a cell overnight. Rodney objects and says they have no evidence, but the inspector wins the argument. She is taken to a cell in the basement of the building. As he leaves, Rodney reassures her that this is a formality, but she doesn't know if that's true. The cell door closes behind him, and all Ella can hear is the sound of the key turning in the lock. The Tatar cocktail bar sits on Tordenskjold Gate, halfway between the canal side and the Kunststal Charlottenburg Art Museum in the centre of Copenhagen. Agent Carling looks up at the barman and makes eye contact. No words are needed for the man to start making another Negroni. The fifth that Carling has had, since he sat down on this stool at the end of the bar, at just after 10 p.m. There is no doubt that losing Morrison will have a profound effect on his career in MI6. Up until now, he has thought that he would make steady progress up to the higher echelons of the service, sometime towards his 50th birthday, then enjoy a city flat and country house as a man of importance. All that dream now seems to be in tatters inside his Negroni-laced mind. The barman puts a glass down in front of him, and Carling immediately picks it up and knocks back a third of the dark liquid with the worrying speed of someone quenching their thirst, rather than enjoying the glamour of a cocktail. He looks across the bar from his eyrie at the far end of the room. He sees all bright young things, all laughing with each other, all moneyed in a way he has never known yet. He could have been them a few years ago, but he doesn't know now.
Mr. Carter, isn't it?
The voice comes at him from the ether somewhere. Carling looks around and sees a woman in a silver dress, her blonde hair loose around her shoulders, and her large blue eyes set evenly in an open face. She obviously knows him, but he still doesn't recognize her.
Sorry,
he says.
Freya. Freya Hansen from the hospital.
Carling is still bemused.
I'm Dr. Hansen. I looked after your friend.
Dr. Hansen, he repeats back slowly, then remembers her.
Oh, I'm sorry. The drink made me forget for a second. How many have you had?
I don't know.
Are you here with someone?
She says. He indicates the empty stool beside him.
As you see, quite alone. You mind if I join you? My friends won't miss me for a few minutes.
Be my guest.
He raises his hand to the barman, who scuttles over to them expectantly.
Aperol, please.
she says to the man, then smiles at Carling.
What brings you to a bar in downtown Copenhagen at midnight, on a Saturday, and all on your own?
He takes a deep breath. Work.
Tell me.
I was supposed to be looking after the prof, when he disappeared.
The prof?
She says. Morrison, the guy you saw.
What do you mean, disappeared?
Her eyes widening, even more than their natural size.
He just walked away.
What's your first name?
She says. For a full 5 seconds, Carling can't, for the life of him, remember the first name of his cover life as Mr. Carter. Then it comes back to him.
Francis.
She laughs.
You must have had a few. It takes you that long to remember your own name.
He laughs with her and shakes his head in mock humor. They talk on about their work, then themselves, then their dreams. Freya's friends come up to her after an hour to say that they're going, and she tells them that she'll stay, which sends a warm feeling through Carling's brain. She's single, had a big relationship in her 20s, but it didn't work out, and there's been no one significant since, in 3 years. By 2 a.m., the words don't flow so easily, and she says they should go. When Carling stands up for the first time in a while, the Negronis make him wobble, and she finds it funny. They walk out into the street and turn towards the canal.
There's a taxi,
she says, and raises her arm. A green Audi coasts into the curb beside them. She turns to him.
I've enjoyed myself.
Me too,
he says, then struggles to find more words.
You're supposed to ask for my number,
she says, and smiles. He starts to say something, but she pushes a business card into his hand and kisses him on the cheek, then opens the cab door. As the car accelerates away, for a second she turns and looks back at him, standing on the corner. Laravelle pushes out into the street on her way to get some food, as there's nothing left in her flat. As she emerges back out of the shop, she can see two figures in the shadows on the opposite side of the street. She pulls up her hood and hurries back the way she came. The two people immediately start to walk, tracking her movement on the other side of the road. Laravelle decides to take a diversion, as she doesn't want to reveal the location of her flat, particularly as it is an MI6 safe house and needs to be invisible. She turns right into a side street, then crosses the road and dives into an alleyway that runs in parallel. The passageway is littered with dustbins, overflowing from a week's human existence. She pushes past the bins and moves them into the center of the alleyway to stop any followers. But the two figures seem to have long gone. She reaches the end of the 50 yards of the alleyway and steps out into another side street. She turns sharp left, puts her hands in her pockets and walks at pace. She doesn't look back, and after 5 minutes she slows her walk after checking behind her, and there's no one there. Her body relaxes and she thinks about the quickest route back to her flat from where she has ended up. The blow seems to come from nowhere. A fist, directly in her stomach. She bends double. Her bag and food spill out onto the paving in front of her, and she hits the ground. When the kick comes, she is no more prepared. A boot, again in her stomach. The kicks keep coming, and she doesn't fight back, letting the pain cascade through her muscles. Her energy has gone, and her limp body moves across the ground with each blow.
All right, Alex.
It's Oana's voice. The blows stop, but the pain doesn't. Oana is next to her now, close up in her face.
Thought you'd fooled us, didn't you?
Laravelle doesn't try to talk. Here's the new deal, Sabrina.
Ioana whispers with venom.
We don't like being taken for mugs. And given that you have the whole of British intelligence to help you now, the plan has changed. You need to kill the boy within a week, or Alex here will come and find you.
Larivel is still.
Got it?
Ioana slaps her.
Grant once for yes.
Larivel is silent.
Or shall we kill you now?
Says Ioana.
Is that what you want?
Larivel whispers.
No.
Ioana stands up and pushes Larivel's weak body with her foot.
Scum,
she says. And they walk away, leaving her alone with her pain.